first case for argument is Nissenbaum versus Milwaukee County. Mr. Olson.
Good morning. The sole issue raised by the plaintiff's appeal is that the district court erred in dismissing on summary judgment three of the defendants in this action, concluding that dismissal was appropriate because those three individuals were not aware of Mr. Nissenbaum's protected speech. The evidence in this case, however, is to the contrary, in that it was specifically found by the court in its decision that not only Mr. Bazdaka, the remaining defendant in the action, but also Mr. Van Felder, Mr. Lauer, and Ms. Harmon were also aware of those campaign materials, and that it was included in the court's findings of fact. So the ruling by the court is internally inconsistent in that the judge found there were material issues of fact in dispute that Mr. Bazdaka was aware of the protected speech and therefore could have been motivated by that protected speech. And the same analysis.
How many votes did he get when he ran for clerk?
I'm sorry?
How many votes did he get?
How many votes did he get? I believe, you mean in comparison to his opponent?
Yeah.
About half, I believe.
Uh-huh. So he was a serious candidate?
Oh, yes. He had run for that office at least twice.
Uh-huh. Good.
And that issue is the sole issue on the plaintiff's appeal. It's rather straightforward. And that was a cross appeal filed in response to.
Before we get to the cross appeal, let me just ask what difference it makes whether anybody knew he was running for office. The ground on which the judgment is being defended is that the people you sued had nothing to do with the decision, which was indeed made before he filed for his run.
Well, they were, in fact, involved in the decision. They were each individuals who were in the chain of events that led to the so-called abolishment of his job.
Abolition is the word.
Pardon me?
Abolition.
The abolition of his job. And thank you, Your Honor. Ultimately, we know, however, that there was another individual hired to perform the same functions that he was performing after the abolition of the job.
The problem is, though, these new security responsibilities kicked in, and the decision to restructure was in June, and his campaigning began in August. And so that's where the problem is. I think that's what Judge Easterbrook was getting at.
Well, there were indeed ongoing discussions about changing the functions. However, there were admissions by current management employees, as well as individuals who ultimately replaced Mr. Nissenbaum and Mr. Nissenbaum himself, that Mr. Nissenbaum was fully qualified to perform those functions and had performed those functions all along. So the issue is not necessarily whether there was an abolition of the job or the position, but did they use that as a ruse to eliminate Mr. Nissenbaum from the workforce and then bring someone else in, even though they admitted that they, being management, that as the incumbent, Mr. Nissenbaum should have been considered for that position. With respect to the appeal by the defense, they have claimed that...
And before you get to that,
yes,
Nissenbaum,
Your Honor,
didn't apply for the position of security coordinator after he was laid off, did he?
No, he did not. He was not given that opportunity. He went through the exit interview process with the Human Resources Department and had expressed his interest in continuing in that position, and they denied him any opportunity to apply or interview for the job. With respect to the defense's appeal, they've claimed that the case is frivolous and that there were problems with discovery and with affidavits in the case. They've brought numerous motions throughout this litigation. Each of those the court carefully considered, even though they were fraught with
procedural defects in failing to file proper certificates by defense counsel, failing to confer in good faith with plaintiff's counsel, failing to file a brief, failing to file a certificate. Nonetheless, the court went beyond those procedural defects and carefully considered each of those motions. There are two motions on summary judgment. There's a motion for reconsideration, two Rule 50 motions during the trial, and the court considered each of those, and the argument by defense that the case was frivolous and lacked any basis in fact, and rejected each of those arguments and the facts as presented by defense counsel.
Can you speak to the confidentiality agreement and whether Nissenbaum violated that?
The confidentiality agreement?
Right. Which regarding information about Thomas Bonsky?
There was no violation by Mr. Nissenbaum. There was a document contained in Mr. Bowinski's personnel file. He ultimately testified at trial. He didn't testify on that particular subject, and that was immediately withdrawn by the court. The court considered it and didn't find that there was any impropriety or any disclosure by plaintiff or plaintiff's counsel. With respect to the affidavit of Mr. I don't recall his name offhand, but that was immediately withdrawn when it was discovered that the individual who notarized that statement had not sworn him in. It was simply notarized apparently after the fact, and that information was provided to me by defense counsel's office, and we withdrew the affidavit. The court considered those facts as well, and there was no finding of any impropriety or frivolousness on that basis. Unless the panel has additional questions, I'd like to...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Mr. Levinson?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Jeremy Levinson. Myself and my colleague Shannon Allen represent the appellees, cross-appellants, Milwaukee County, Daryl Bezdaka, Doris Herman, Cortez Van Felder, and Daryl Bezdaka. I think it makes sense to begin with Mr. Olson's appeal first. I think ultimately both of these appeals can be resolved on extremely straightforward grounds. Mr. Olson's appeal contends that Mr. Lauer, Ms. Harmon, and Mr. Van Felder should have been brought back into the lawsuit, and that this court should remand for a new trial as to their liability with respect to the layoff, the abolition of Mr. Nissenbaum. That question can be answered very easily. As one of the judges pointed out, the decision was made to abolish that position long before even Mr. Nissenbaum alleges anyone knew of his protected activity. The document that the chairman...
They knew he was running, didn't they?
Not at the point the decision was made. And page 41 of our appendix, which is in the record, establishes beyond any doubt that the decision was made before even Mr. Nissenbaum alleges anyone knew of his activity. Mr. Nissenbaum, throughout most of the litigation, stated that he...
I made a distinction between his running for this office and the contents of his... campaign materials.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe this circuit has distinguished between the fact of someone running for office, which is in and of itself not protected by the Constitution, as opposed to the substance.
I don't understand that distinction.
Well, it's the Bart versus Telford case, and paraphrasing this court, it states that the First Amendment does not guarantee in and of itself the right to run for office. It is substantive political views that are protected.
Well, that's true, but if you know someone wants to run against you, it's because the campaign is going to involve protected speech. Obviously, a candidate has to say something in order to persuade the electorate to vote for him. So if you stifle his, deter his running, aren't you infringing on First Amendment rights?
I think in a number of cases that could be the case. I will further concede that the distinction is a very fine one. I am pleased to tell the court that neither of those events, either the substance or the fact of his campaign, was known to anybody, including himself. He hadn't made the decision yet. There's no question that his protected activity did not begin and was not heard about by anyone until at least July 1998. What this document says is that the decision to abolish his position was made by these defendants necessarily no later than June 12th, 1998. This is again in our appendix at 41. It was introduced to trial. It was a piece of one of plaintiff's exhibits. It can be found at the record at 144, exhibit 30. That's a collection of documents. The one with the label Niesenbaum 2007. The testimony in the case was this is a budget worksheet. It shows a zero out of Mr. Niesenbaum's position. This document establishes that in June, the decision had been made to abolish that position. Authenticity was stipulated, and it was admitted at trial. It is unimpeached and uncontradicted and, frankly, indisputable. Not only before this document came into being, there was zero evidence in this case that the defendants knew about Mr. Nissenbaum's campaign when they made the decision. We brought forth affirmative evidence that they didn't and they could not have. And I would refer this court to its decision in Atkins versus Briggs and Stratton, in which Judge Reynolds was reversed, and this court found that it is frivolous to bring a lawsuit when the decision was made at a time the decision maker was unaware of the protected status or activity. So that's the first reason that Mr. Olson's appeal can be resolved quite simply. A second reason is the standards for a prima facie case of First Amendment violation in the context of employment are very clear. The Vukadovich case, and I can recite that, but I suspect the panel is aware of it. Per Celotex, a defendant merely needs to come forward and point out that a plaintiff does not have enough evidence to take his case to a jury, at which point a plaintiff has the job of showing he or she engaged in protected activity, that protected activity was known to decision makers, and the decision that is complained of was substantially motivated by that protected activity. That is the plaintiff's job on summary judgment, and there's nothing in this record that bore plaintiff's burden in this respect. And I want to point something out to the court that is quite extraordinary. In both summary judgment decisions, the court below, I'm quoting now, from the record at 65, page 20, in our appendix at 23, this is denying most of our first summary judgment motion. Neither party has presented proposed findings of fact to identify or establish the plaintiff's allegedly protected speech. Close quote. That finding mandated summary judgment for all of the defendants. From that same decision, this is at page 23 of the decision itself. The facts do not establish when the decision was made by the Department of Public Works to propose elimination of the security supervisor position from the 1999 budget. Moreover, the court lacks specific facts to make the ultimate determination that the elimination of the security supervisor position was unrelated to the plaintiff's protected speech. In this case, the defendants on summary judgment were required to disprove any possible case plaintiff may have. Be that as it may, the case was tried, and in about 45 minutes, the jury came back for the final defendant, and it was over. But here we are again, seeking a new trial. And in fact, despite the district court's decisions, the plaintiff has obligations to have a certain amount of evidence before launching this type of case. There is still we're coming up on, I believe, the fourth anniversary of this litigation. The evidence is that most of the individual defendants had absolutely nothing to do with the complaint of decision. The one that had something to do with the complaint of decision, in fact, made that decision long before anyone, including the plaintiff himself, knew anything about protected activity. And what ensued was 3.5 years of litigation. I wish that was all that was the problem with this case. What else we have in this case I'd like to give a prefatory comment to what I'm about to say. I understand that this appeal makes very serious assertions, and I want to assure the court we take responsibility.
Well, what is the worst example of sanctionable conduct by your opponent?
Well, I think there are many competing.
Well, why?
I'll give you one.
The worst?
I'll give you one. At his deposition, when asked for the basis of this lawsuit, plaintiff testified under oath he was treated as a wonderful employee before he ran for office, and after he ran for office, it was the first time anyone mentioned him losing his job. That's what he swore to under oath. At that point, I wrote a letter to Mr. Olson. I said, "Mr. Olson, your client just testified no one's ever threatened his job before." I directed him to personnel documents that we had provided him that showed, in fact, I think about 8 months, 10 months earlier, plaintiff had been found to have falsified a county medical form in order to make a fraudulent workers' compensation claim and take 6 or 7 weeks of paid vacation to which he wasn't entitled. Most of the defendants, those that were involved in that disciplinary process, recommended and sought his discharge. And the DPW, the Department of Public Works, in fact, resolved to discharge him. In the record, and I'd be happy to give you the record sites if you'd like them, are a transcript in which plaintiff and his lawyer, another attorney, not Mr. Olson, participated in a disciplinary proceeding. There are then notices that you've been found to have violated very serious rules and are being discharged. There's a transcript of defendant Mr. Lauer walking plaintiff to his locker to clean out his locker. There has been a notice that there will be an appeal to the Personnel Review Board. And then there's a 14 or 15 or 20 page Personnel Review Board findings of fact and decision. Now, it turns out the PRB ultimately reversed the department and imposed a 90-day unpaid suspension. But for this litigant to swear under oath, my case is based on the fact that no one's ever threatened my job, and I'm looking at 3/4 of an inch of documents, saying not only was your job threatened by these defendants, you were there and actively you retained counsel, you participated, you were given notice upon notice. That was a false statement under oath. I think that's pretty serious. But it's another part of that. I then put Mr. Olson on notice of this, and his response was to put it in paragraph 3 of his proposed findings of fact for summary judgment. And that's in the record at 26. The whole system falls apart if we can just make up information as we need it in a lawsuit. And that's precisely what happened here. I think equally egregious, on the eve of my summary judgment deadline, I received a handful of affidavits. Most of them are virtually identical. Synonyms switched out here and there, but other than that, the substantive portions are identical. I endeavored to interview these people, and two of them at least, Suzanne Lamb and Ron Trotter, said, "I don't know that stuff to be true." Ron Trotter testified, appellant's attorney called me, interviewed me 6 months later, appellant appears at my house, says, "Here's the answers you gave, please sign." He signs, not sworn, it's not notarized, plaintiff takes off with the affidavit, it shows up in court. I show Mr. Trotter the affidavit, go through it line by line. "That's not true, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true, I have no way of knowing X, Y, and Z." I bring that to Mr. Olson's attention. This is, by the way, when he referred to immediately withdrawing it, I believe this is what he was talking about. What in fact happened was, I immediately informed him of this problem, and we basically had a running battle for 3 weeks before he withdrew it from the court. It sat in front of the court for 3 weeks. With Ms. Rem, I interviewed Ms. Rem, and she told me, I said, "Did you understand you were making a statement under oath?" "No." "Did you understand everything in here was supposed to be stuff you knew was true?" "No." And she volunteered to me. This was, Mr. Olson told me this was a group statement, it was information from a lot of people, and we'd all sign it. I said, "Well, so if you saw things in there you didn't know to be true, you would assume it came from somewhere else." "Yes." Now, Mr. Olson produced another affidavit later on in which Ms. Rem somehow reaffirms her first affidavit. That's just a second layer of factual dispute, which is getting to the heart of my appeal. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. This court has made it very clear that a district court must give it something to review for that abuse. And in this case, we have nothing other than several conclusory sentences from the district court as to why the sanctions motions were denied. Let me clarify that. It was a sanctions motion, and then it was later amended. With respect to Mr. Olson's claims of procedural failures, in fact, the safe harbor was observed strictly with respect to both of those motions. That's gratuitous in the second instance, but it was observed strictly. The summary judgment sanctions decision, the court said, they're basically complaining that plaintiff shouldn't have brought the case, and I found differently, denied. We moved to reconsider both summary judgment and the sanctions motion, saying it wasn't just why we do think the case is frivolous. In fact, there's also this catalog of misconduct. The court's ruling on that amounted to, I've carefully reviewed this case and declined to award sanctions. This is a very typical case in only one respect, that the rulings below on this discretionary decision do not facilitate review by this court, and what we're left with are a series of factual disputes best be resolved in the full hearing, the full evidentiary hearing before a district court, as is typical for a substantial sanctions motion. And that is why I think this court can certainly make some determinations of
sanctions. How much are you seeking?
Excuse me?
How much are you seeking? How much money?
Well, obviously a very discretionary decision. I would presumably argue for my client's entire fees.
What are they?
As I stand here, I couldn't tell you. What I can tell you, I believe they're well north of $100,000. Mm-hmm. What was a frivolous case, what is a frivolous case, what at best should have been an extremely minor brief employment case, turns into a 3.5-year-long, very expensive nightmare. I would like to just quickly run through some of the other problems here. In Mr. Olson's reply brief, Ms. Olson goes to...
Your time has expired.
Ah, thank you, Judge. Appreciate your attention.
Mr. Olson, how much time does he have? 5 minutes?
Thank you. Briefly, in response to Attorney Levinson's comments, Mr. Bezdorka actually testified that the decision to make the to abolish the position had not occurred until the fall of 1998, and then there was a dispute of fact, and later on some contention that perhaps it had happened.
Do you make this point in your brief?
As to when the abolition occurred, I don't believe that I cite that specifically in
the
brief.
There's something very strange about your brief. You complain about dropping of some of the defendants, but you don't really present argument that Nissenbaum's case has merit. There's no causal relation between his candidacy or his campaign and the abolition of his job, then you have no case.
Well, my brief does go through in detail all of the elements of the 1983 action and the evidence supporting not only the prima facie case, but the showing the motivation of the employer and the involvement of each individual in the abolition of the position. In addition to Mr.
You had a two-page statement of fact in which you do more or less preserve your harassment claim, but I don't see anything in here where you meet your opponent's argument that there just was no causal relation between the abolition of the job and the campaign.
Your Honor, I believe that's addressed in the
when I go through each of the elements of the case throughout the blue-covered brief. One of the facts that I set out there is that Mr. Lauer also testified that he got together with Mr. Buzdaka for purposes of establishing the pay rate.
Your summary of argument just complains about the dismissal of the three defendants.
In the, perhaps it's the gray brief, Your Honor, in detailed response to the claims that
put your arguments in the, your opening brief. I didn't see it in your reply brief either.
Which
is mostly devoted to the sanctions issue. I didn't see in your reply brief any response to this point about your client having stated falsely at his deposition that he had never been threatened with termination.
Yes, and I wanted to address that specifically. The questions asked of
him. Why didn't you address it in your reply brief?
I believe I did, Your Honor. The facts,
but anyway,
that I think I set out were that in his deposition.
It's a terrible record. A terrible record as an employee.
He had a very hotly contested relationship with this.
I don't understand that. He seems to have committed all sorts of misfeasance as an employee. I didn't see you take issue with that.
The issue here was whether. There was testimony by managers that he was competent and fully qualified to continue working in that position. And the
there was also evidence of misconduct on his part, which had jeopardized his job. Now, at least that's what your opponent says. Now, I didn't see any response to that in your briefs, but maybe did he misstate the? He said that your client testified in his deposition that he'd never had any reason to think his job was in jeopardy. Now, is that what he said? Is that true?
Well, he was asked by Mr. Levinson what led him to believe that the running for office caused some kind of a change in the way he was treated in the workplace. Mr. Nissenbaum was told by the managers, you'd better hope you win the election and you're not going to have a job. And he identified that specifically.
That's a separate point.
Well, it's not just a point
that he said. Did he testify that before he ran the election, he had no reason to think his job was in jeopardy? Is that what he said?
No. He said that after he ran for office, they made these comments. He was...
What did he say about before he ran for office?
Didn't he say he'd been a good worker?
That he had been a good worker.
Right, those were the words that he said. Right.
Right. That he'd been a good worker, that he, on a daily basis, in talking with his managers in the workplace, it wasn't a problem. And then in the hallway, after he ran for office, they made those statements. You better hope you win the election or you're not going to have a job. And they began treating him poorly on a day-to-day basis, working. Didn't have anything to do with the discipline process.
So you don't dispute that he had all those problems at work?
Well, there certainly was a long history of problems.
But you don't think that's inconsistent with him saying he was a good worker?
No. I think, and it's consistent with what the managers testified to, that he's qualified to do the job. Mr. Lauer testified to that. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both. Yeah.